Great. So today we're talking about the third stage on the path, this third stage of the threefold path, which is wisdom. So over the last 2 days, the Buddha's been teaching us about the first two stages of the path. Firstly, about ethics, and then yesterday about meditation. So the Buddha was teaching us about developing mindfulness, concentration, how we tame our minds, and the importance of cultivating love. So we heard the Buddha teaching us about that through the Dhammapada yesterday. And all the time just remembering to be open to the Buddha as our teacher through these teachings, trying to cultivate this sense of being with the Buddha through these teachings. So in a way, remembering or reflecting on that the Buddha would have been naturally ethical, he would have been meditating, and in the way that we practice ethics and practice meditation, we are following in his footsteps. So just using that as a way of cultivating faith or cultivating confidence in your connection with the Buddha and with the Buddha as your teacher, knowing that in practicing ethics and practicing meditation, you are doing as he would have done. Yeah. So just using that as a real confidence, and something to really stand on in your life and in your practice. So today we'll be looking at the third stage of the threefold path, which is wisdom. So in this talk, I want to just first, I'm going to give a bit of a background to wisdom as the third great stage of the path. And then we'll let the Buddha teach us about the three lakshanas using those verses from the Dhammapada. So we'll be looking at wisdom through the Dhammapada, through the three lakshanas today. And then I'm going to finish the talk just talking a little bit about the practice of contemplation. So firstly, just getting a background of what wisdom is in terms of the third great stage of the threefold path. So Sangharaksha says, he says, the third great stage of the threefold path is wisdom. This isn't, of course, any kind of mental activity. By wisdom, here is meant direct, sustained awareness of reality. So wisdom is us moving through these levels of wisdom, the levels of wisdom that we talked about on the first day and we've kept coming back to. So we hit the first level of wisdom, the wisdom that we hear about. So we're hearing the Buddha teaching us. Then the second level of wisdom, the wisdom that we cultivate through reflection. So we're taking those teachings into our being and reflecting on them. Moving into the third level of wisdom, which is the wisdom that we cultivate in meditation through contemplation. And this third level of wisdom is very much the wisdom of the third great stage of the spiritual path. So in terms of the threefold way, we've been practicing ethics. We've been practicing our skillful actions of body, speech and mind. We've been practicing meditation based on our ethically skillful action and developing calm, concentrated, integrated positive states of mind. And then from those positive states of mind, we're trying to open up to wisdom, to gain insight, this direct, sustained awareness of reality. So we're not just hearing the Buddha's teaching. So the first lakshana, that all conditioned things are impermanent. We're taking that into our being and seeing that truth in a direct, sustained awareness that that is true in our experience. So this is the third level of wisdom. So Sangharaksha says, he says, insight is not just an intellectual understanding. It can be developed only on a basis of a controlled, purified, elevated, concentrated, integrated mind. In other words, through meditative practice. Insight is a direct intuitive perception that takes place in the depths of meditation, when the ordinary mental processes have fallen into abeyance. A preliminary intellectual understanding of the teachings is certainly helpful, but ultimately insight is something that transcends the intellectual workings of the mind. But we can't jump straight to wisdom. We have to move through these levels of wisdom. We have to hear the teachings. We have to reflect on them, develop this reflective acceptance. And then we have to cultivate a mind through our meditation that can hold those truths in it enough to contemplate them and really see them in our experience, see reality. So there's this lovely quote, which I very much like, which says, "One who sees the truth sees the Buddha." So, or "one who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha." So when we see the Dharma, when we see the truth of things in our actual experience, then we see the Buddha, we meet the Buddha through seeing the truth of the Dharma, through seeing reality, through seeing things the way they really are. So in this sense, we meet the Buddha through reality. So this is the ultimate aim of our spiritual practice, is to gain wisdom into the way things really are, to awaken to the truth. So we're going to be looking at three verses from the Dhammapada, verse 277 through to 279, which is the Buddha teaching us about the three lakshanas. And we can use these teachings of the three lakshanas as a way to cultivating wisdom, for gaining insight, for seeing things the way they really are. So these are the verses. The Buddha says, "All conditioned things are impermanent. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. All conditioned things are painful. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. All things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity." So the Buddha very directly, clearly saying that if we can see that conditioned existence is indeed impermanent, unsatisfactory and insubstantial, seeing conditioned existence in those ways, this is the way to purity. Yeah. So this is the way to wisdom. This is the way to awakening, to truth. So this is the Buddha, these verses are the Buddha really giving us pith instructions, if you like, for how we can tread the third stage of the spiritual path. He's really asking us to really look at our experience and see its true nature. So we'll take them verse by verse. So the first verse, 277, "All conditioned things are impermanent. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity." In the Pali, that's sabbe samskara anicca. All conditioned things are impermanent. So first off, we've got this, the first two words are all conditioned things. So conditioned in the sense literally means things that are put together. Yeah. So you hear in Buddhism, it referred to as the conditioned and the unconditioned. So the conditioned literally being things that are put together, and the unconditioned literally being things that are not put together, things that are simple, natural. And one way that I find it helpful to think about conditioned things is remembering the key core central teaching of Buddhism, Pratitya Samuppada, conditionality. This being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. So conditioned things, here things are conditioned. On the basis of this being, that becomes. On the ceasing of that, that ceases. Yes, so this is the fundamental core teaching of Buddhism, if you like. And because things are conditioned, they are impermanent. Yeah, they're changing. They are changing because they are conditioned. When this being, that becomes. Yeah, so on the basis of one, on the basis of A, B arises. A not being there, B disappears. So it's impermanent because it is conditioned. So conditioned things have to be impermanent. And this is a universal truth. It applies to absolutely everything. It's right in front of us all the time, this truth of impermanence. It's not an esoteric teaching. It's not really subtle and hard to get hold of. It's in your everyday, every moment experience, impermanence. It's right in front of us. So we are impermanent. Our breath, our bodies, our heartbeats. Others are impermanent. Their breath, their bodies, their heartbeats. The way that we relate to each other is impermanent. Our meetings and our partings, our birth and our death. The world we live in is impermanent. The rain, the sun, the nature, the seasons coming and going, the flowers going from bud to blossom to fading, and those old empires that we go and visit, now rubble, once glorious buildings. So everything in our world is impermanent, because it's put together, and when those things that are not put together come apart, they change, they are impermanent. So this impermanence is integral to life itself, and it's a very simple truth, and yet it's a very hard truth to really let in. And it always has been a hard truth to let in. So you have Ananda on the Buddha's in his final days, about to die, and Ananda, who's been his faithful assistant for years and years, leading up to the Buddha's death, he's really weeping and sorrowful that the Buddha is going to die. And the Buddha goes to Ananda and he says, "Do not sorrow, Ananda. Have I not told you many times that everything changes and vanishes? How could something that has come into being not be destroyed?" Yeah. So it's a hard truth to see. It's a hard truth to really let in. But it is the way things are. All things are impermanent. And life is teaching us this all the time. We just need to try and open to this teaching, to let life teach us. And one way we can do that is just turning it over in our minds, dropping into our beings. All conditioned things are impermanent. We're reminding ourselves of this teaching from the Buddha. And one day, maybe wisdom will dawn and you'll see that you and all conditioned things are impermanent. And the Buddha says in verse 113, he says, "Better than 100 years lived unaware of the rise and fall of conditioned things. is one single day lived aware of the rise and fall of conditioned things. And I often reflect on this verse when I'm on retreat, especially when we've got a whole day of silence coming up tomorrow. And I think, ah, better is that single day lived aware of the rise and fall of conditioned things. So maybe I can just put all of my energy or my purpose just for a single day into trying to see this arise and fall of conditioned things. So that's the first of the three lakshanas. So the second is all conditioned things are painful. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. Sabbe sanskara dukkha. All conditioned things are painful. So again, we're talking about conditioned things. We're talking about things that are put together. And dukkha, translated as painful, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. Literally, the main part of the word is the ka, which comes from the word connected to chakra, which is wheel. And duk, meaning a prefix that means not good or bad or ill or wrong. So dukkha literally means ill-fitting chariot wheel. Which I quite like, because it's kind of like life is a bit of a bumpy ride. It's an ill-fitting chariot wheel. Yeah. So all conditioned things are dukkha. And the Buddha said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And this can feel a bit pessimistic, can't it? We're talking about impermanence, we're talking about suffering. But actually, it's not pessimistic. Have you ever noticed how when life's going really well and you're happy and you're swimming along, how often do you ask questions? Oh, why am I so happy? And what's the meaning of this? And yet when you're in that state of suffering and life's a bit painful, you ask questions, don't you? You ask, why is it like this? And how can I be free of this suffering? So in a way, this is why the Buddha teaches so much about suffering and the end of suffering. Because suffering is where we ask those questions. Yeah, so in terms of the spiral path, suffering is the first step of the spiral path. And it is from suffering that faith arises. Because it's in those times of suffering that we ask questions. So there's lots of different lists. The Buddha's good at lists, isn't he? And there's lots of different lists looking at dukkha and different ways of looking at dukkha. But I thought I'd share with you the seven different aspects of dukkha in life. So the Buddha says birth is painful. Sickness is painful. Old age is painful. Death is painful. Contact with what one dislikes is painful. Separation from what one likes is painful. And not getting what one wants is painful. So life has these seven different aspects of dukkha, of what is painful. It might be good just to reflect on those and reflect on the reflect on those and what is it in your life that you find painful? Where does dukkha show up for you? Is it contact with what you dislike, whether it's people or work or noise or the weather? Or is it separation from what you like, leaving family, leaving places you love? Or is it not getting what you want? Yeah, so where does dukkha show up for you in your life? And it can be worth reflecting a little bit on Dukkha being a whole range of experience. So it's a range of experience from things that are very painful, feel very painful, you want to call them painful, to the things that are just a bit more unsatisfactory. Yeah, so it's a whole range of experience. I prefer unsatisfactoriness, actually, as personally, as a translation of dukkha. So life is unsatisfactory in all these different ways. And I think sometimes I take that a bit personally. So when my life is a bit, something's happening in my life that I'm finding a bit painful, I take it personally. I think I must be doing something wrong that my life, that I'm experiencing pain. Because if I was getting it right, then I'd surely be happy. And I think it's really helpful just to remember that dukkha isn't personal. Yeah, life is unsatisfactory. We will have contact with what we dislike. We will have separation from what we like. And we won't always get what we want. And that's everybody. That isn't just you. Yeah, so the Buddha's really teaching us about dukkha, about unsatisfactoriness. And you get this great sutta in the Pali Canon where the Buddha talks about two types of suffering. Yeah, it's the Sutta of the Two Darts or the Two Arrows. It's quite famous, you might know it. So in a way, suffering has these two aspects. The suffering which is just inherent in having a physical body and inherent in having a human existence. There is pain in that. And then there's all the suffering that we add unnecessarily to that experience. So that's our mental suffering. So it's really important that we distinguish between these two types of suffering, because we will experience pain, physical suffering in our life. And that's unavoidable. So when we're talking about eradicating suffering, we're talking about eradicating the mental suffering. So I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs from What is the Dhamma. So Sangharaksha says, I should perhaps mention here that we're talking about mental suffering, not physical suffering. There is a passage in the Pali Canon to which one of my teachers, Bhikkhu Kashyap, with whom I studied Pali and Abhidharma, was very fond of referring. In this passage, the Buddha is seated cross-legged, teaching his disciples, and after he has been teaching for a long time, his back starts aching. Even a Buddha's back aches. Shariputra happened to be there, and well, the Buddha didn't just grin and bear it. He, as some people might say we ought to, he said, Shariputra, my back is aching, please take over teaching, I'll just lie down. My teacher, Kashyapji, used to be fond of referring to this incident, because, as he emphasized, it illustrated the humanity of the Buddha, not in the sense that the Buddha had human weaknesses in the mental or emotional sense, but he had physical weaknesses. He had an ordinary human body, and that body, as he grew older, caused him pain. In Buddhism, a distinction is made between physical pain and mental pain. When you gain enlightenment, you no longer experience any mental pain or emotional turbulence or anything of that sort. But you are still subject to physical pain, which you bear, as the Buddha did, with equanimity. It's really just very important to know the difference between our physical suffering that is just part of having a human body and the mental suffering that we add, or the unnecessary suffering that we add to that painful experience. And the Buddha, he also talked about and taught a lot about dukkha and suffering. Again, not to be pessimistic, but because we have a bit of a tendency to avoid what is painful. Yeah. So a bit like what I talked about yesterday, in relation to our experience, we can have these two tendencies of blocking and drowning. And we need to turn towards our experience. We need to turn towards our both the pleasant and the unpleasant aspects of our experience. Yeah, so if we're having unpleasant experience, do we block off from it or do we drown in it? So we need to turn towards our experience, all of our experience. And that does also mean turning towards our pleasant experience. So it could be worth reflecting whether you're someone who tends to turn more towards painful experience or pleasant experience. Because although I think we all avoid or try to avoid our painful experience, I think we also all struggle, well I certainly do, with letting in our pleasant experience. And part of the spiritual life, I think, really can be learning towards turning towards pleasant experience. So it might just be worth noticing in your experience whether you turn more easily towards the pleasant or the unpleasant aspects of your experience. What are you more comfortable with? Are you more comfortable telling someone how rubbish you're feeling and all the bad things that have happened to you today? Or are you more comfortable rejoicing in your life and the pleasant experience? So I think there can be a lot of merit in spending time reflecting on our pleasant experience. I personally really need to do that, actually, find ways into moving towards pleasant experience. So the Buddha developed equanimity. Yeah, equanimity both to the pleasant experience and the painful experience. So equanimity doesn't mean grinning and bearing painful experience. It means being equanimous to both painful and pleasant experience. In a way, it's a radical acceptance of your experience just as it is. In verse 84 of the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, "Touch now by pleasure, now by pain. The spiritually mature shows neither elation or depression." So that's equanimity. So the third lakshana, or the third verse, all conditioned things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. Sabbe Dhamma Anatta. All things are not self, or all things are devoid of unchanging selfhood. So you'll notice that's different from the last two verses. So in the last two verses we had all conditioned things. And in this verse we have all things. So all things are devoid of unchanging selfhood. So all conditioned things are impermanent and painful. And all things are devoid of unchanging selfhood. So Dhamma literally means all things. Yeah, so this is both samsara and nirvana, the conditioned and the unconditioned, the put together and the not put together, the artificial and the natural. So all things are not self. All things are devoid of unchanging selfhood. So the danger here is that we can fall into a big nihilistic hole and think there's nothing out there, there's no self, there's nothing. So that's a danger. So notice if that's a danger that you fall into. I can find it much more helpful to think about this in terms of no fixed self rather than no self. So for me, no self tends to tip more towards that nihilistic nothingness. There's nothing there. I don't exist. What is this experience I'm having then? Whereas if I can think about this in terms of no fixed self, that's much more helpful. So we've already established that we're impermanent, that we're changing, that because we're made up of conditions, that those conditions have to change and are impermanent. So in a way, this lakshana comes out of that. If we are impermanent, there can't be anything fixed. So there's nothing in us that's fixed. There's no fixed essence or self or soul. We are arising and passing away based upon conditions. And so this, if you're someone who falls into nihilism, this might feel quite dark. But actually, this is very exciting, this lakshana. Because in a way, because we are not fixed, it means we can change. So if we were fixed, then we wouldn't be able to change. So it's the fact that we're not fixed, that there is no fixed self, that we can, that change is possible, that we can become Buddhas. Yeah? So it's very exciting. And it could be worth just exploring in our groups how we fix self. So this truth is saying that all things are devoid of unchanging selfhood, that all things are devoid of a fixed self. So how do you fix yourself? What are your favourite fixed self views? And it can be worth just noticing where the self turns up for you. Where things feel like me and mine, what you're attached to, when you're the centre of the universe. And I was thinking about different ways of working with this lakshana, and I was thinking about work as practice again. And the opportunity that we have through work as practice or helping out at the centre or just generosity actually in whatever form it's manifesting, that there's something about that generosity for others that enables us to transcend self. So we might do something for someone else which just takes us out of our own preference for how we want it to be done. Yeah. So it might be worth thinking about different ways, you know, where we have our preferences, we have our habits of self, and putting ourselves in situations where we have to transcend those habits of self a little bit. So all conditioned things are impermanent. All conditioned things are painful. All things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. Yes, as I said earlier, these verses are really the Buddha giving us pith teachings on how we can gain wisdom. You know, if we can see with insight that conditioned things are impermanent, unsatisfactory and substantial, if we can see them in our experience, we can have a direct, sustained awareness of them in our experience. Then we become weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. So this phrase, weary of suffering, literally means to turn away from suffering. And Bhante, in his seminar, when he's talking about these verses, he makes it very clear that this is not just a psychological reaction. You're not just turning away because you're personally repelled by things, but you're turning away because you see the true nature. You become weary of things because you see that they are impermanent and unsatisfactory and devoid of unchanging selfhood. Therefore, you turn away. So it's not a turning away in aversion to things. He says, you see through it. You see through the things that cause suffering, and so you withdraw from them. You stop putting your energy into conditioned things. So these are the pith teachings, yeah, that the Buddha's given us. So now I'm just going to talk a little bit about, okay, so what do we do with that? Yeah, how do we contemplate those teachings? So we'll come back again to these three levels of wisdom. So the first level, the Sutra Maya Pranya, the wisdom that you read or hear about. The second level, the Chinta Maya Pranya, the wisdom cultivated through reflection on the teaching. And the third level, the Bhavana Maya Pranya, the wisdom cultivated in meditation through contemplation. So we can use those levels of wisdom as a framework. So the first level, we're reading. Let's take the first lakshana. So we're taking permanence. So in the first level of wisdom, we're gonna read or listen to teachings on impermanence. So you might do that by reading this verse from the Dhammapada over and over. Yes, yeah, so you could do it like that, or you could read other suttas from the Pali Canon or teachings on impermanence. And just keep reading different teachings on impermanence. There's lots of poetry which invoke this beautiful quality of impermanence. So there might be a poem for you that helps you contact the teaching of impermanence. So you can read poetry. So when you've got those teachings and you're reading them or hearing about them, then we're going to start reflecting on them, developing this second level of wisdom. So you might just reflect on the verse, thinking about them. Is that true in your experience? You might discuss that with a friend. Discuss how impermanence shows up in your life, or how unsatisfactoriness shows up in your life. You might study different teachings together and ask questions. So you're really trying to do all your questioning. You're really trying to develop a reflective acceptance that this teaching is true. So your mind, you've accepted in your mind that this teaching is true. And we need to do all the questioning and thinking about these truths before we move on to contemplation and the third stage. Because otherwise we get into trying to contemplate the truth and we just start thinking about it. So in a way, we need to keep reflecting on the truth for as long as we need to. That's very, very fruitful. We don't need to rush through these stages, actually. Yeah. So just keep reflecting on it for as long as we need to. And then at certain times in our life, we might be ripe for contemplation. And when we're contemplating, we're holding the word in our minds. So normally we've developed a still, concentrated, positive mind in meditation. Bhante gave us a very long list earlier, didn't he? Controlled, purified, elevated, concentrated, integrated mind. So once we've developed a mind like that, then we can hold a word like impermanence in our mind and contemplate it. Just allow it to have an effect. And sometimes it, with something like impermanence, it can be helpful to think about to contemplate the impermanence of something, so impermanence of your body or of a loved one. So we're contemplating the impermanence of something. And this is where we can start using something like the mindfulness of breathing, which we traditionally use as a way of developing calm and concentration. Well, we can take it that step further and using it as a vipassana practice, as a practice of spiritual death and of seeing it, of gaining insight. Because the breath, of course, and our bodily sensations of the breath are impermanent. So we can use our breath and our bodily sensations as a way of contemplating impermanence. I wanted to share with you this paragraph from Ratnaguna's book on called The Art of Reflection. It's a very, very, very helpful book which explores these levels of wisdom and the practice of reflection and contemplation in more detail. And Ratnaguna just writes with such humanness and lightness. I really like the way that he teaches. Anyway, he says, impermanence is not some arcane, esoteric truth, one has to be initiated into. It's blindingly obvious. We just have to look around us to see it. The trouble is that we spend a lot of our energy trying to ignore and evade it. So when we contemplate impermanence, we aren't trying to see something subtle or elusive. We are simply trying to stop denying what is right in front of us. Contemplation is a coming to terms with reality that is all around us and within us, rather than trying to understand something obscure and difficult. So when we have a deeper insight into impermanence, it's not that we have learned some new information. It's more that we have accepted the obvious truth more deeply than we were previously able to. So I wanted to say a little bit just about, well, the fact of us trying to accept these obvious truths more deeply than we were previously able to. So often we can think about insight or wisdom as this big experience. So we're waiting for this big experience to happen. And all that time while we're waiting for a big experience to happen, we dismiss the real learning that's happening. So there's real learning happening all the time. Yeah, these subtle shifts in our perspective that occur. So Ratnaguna says he thinks it's more useful to think of deepening understanding rather than gaining insight. So don't dismiss the deepening of your understanding, however subtle that might be or small that might be. Don't dismiss that waiting for a big experience. So I think I also wanted to say that whilst Bhante talks about insight coming from the depth of our meditative experience, and it can, of course. Thank you. So insight or wisdom can arise in the depths of our meditative experience, but it doesn't have to. So that's the other misconception about insight. So insight, we can be waiting, as I said, for this big experience to happen. And we can think it has to happen on the cushion, and that's not true either. So in some Buddhist contemplative traditions, there's another pattern which is quite traditional, that someone might sit down and do an intense period of concentration. And then after that concentration, they relax. Phew! And then in that period of relaxation, something happens. Something happens that catalyzes, that's a catalyst to seeing insight. So it's not always in that period of intense concentration that insight happens. It can happen in that relaxation, which is why it's very important to do this absorbing phase as well at the end of meditation, not to jump off the cushion. So we've been working, applying effort in meditation, and sometimes it's when we relax that the fruits come. Yeah. I wanted to share with you this poem that's from the Theragata, from a Buddhist nun at the time of the Buddha, called Patakara. And it illustrates this point beautifully. She says, "When they plough their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right, and I've followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? Bathing my feet, I watch the bathwater spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and I went to my cell, checked the bed and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed down the wick. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed." So it just illustrates this point, or this sequence, if you like, of intense concentrated practice and then relaxation, and then something very simple in her experience, seeing the going out of the lamp, triggers the breakthrough, triggers the experience of insight. So insight doesn't have to happen when we're on a meditation cushion. It can happen when we've walked out of meditation and we see something and we see reality as it really is. So in these three verses on the Dhammapada, we've been listening to the Buddha giving us pith teachings on wisdom, on the path to wisdom, on this third great stage of the spiritual path. Him saying that by seeing with insight the impermanent, unsatisfactory, insubstantial nature of conditioned things, that this is the way to wisdom and purity. So we've really got a precious opportunity over the next couple of days to really be with the Buddha and let him teach us these teachings, to really try and move through hearing the teachings, reflecting on the teachings, and even perhaps contemplating these teachings, really trying to allow this wisdom to go deeper into our being, to open to seeing things the way they really are. And all the time, just opening to that truth, trying to open to reality, and really allowing yourself to feel taught by the Buddha, to follow in his footsteps, to try and open to the truth that he saw and that he has taught us. Perhaps we can meet the Buddha and be with the Buddha through reality.